Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
December 18th, 2016, and welcome to episode 143 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
VRCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting, and collecting, and collecting. Hi, I'm Michael Mulhern, and I'm your host for 143. And joining me today, up in a slightly snowbound end of the world, is Carrington. How are you, Carrington?
More than slightly snowbound. I look to my right, I look out the window, and then I just don't look anymore. I'm not going outside again for 4 months. Send food.
Okay, so the snow's up to your window?
No, because I'm on the 22nd floor.
Okay, so it's just got up to the 21st.
It's not quite that bad, but just I look out upon a winter wonderland, which is pretty to look at, but I don't want to drive in it or be in it or have anything to actually do with it. That's my opinion of winter. That's what this Canadian thinks of winter.
It's cold.
Baby, it's cold outside.
Well, it's definitely not cold here. Yeah, we just had a few days of it almost hit 40 degrees during the day, and it got down to a wonderful, cool 30 degrees at night.
Ugh. That's too far the other extreme.
Yes, I agree. We should meet in the middle somewhere. So, I don't think Paul's in the middle somewhere. It's a little bit on the cold side where you are, Paul?
It is. Snow has finally stuck. I think it's quite possible that there will be snow from now until the end of winter here.
Until the heat death of the universe.
You had some intermediate sludge for a while, did you?
Some that would come down and then leave again. You know, can't decide what temperature to be. But
but now it's just going to stick around for a while.
I think so.
Mm. Wouldn't mind a couple of bales of snow down here, but I don't think it would last that long.
Well, I'll package some up and send it.
Mm. Just make sure it's watertight. Well, that's the weather out of the way. So let's just have a little bit of a retrospective, looking back at our acquisitions of 2016. What were your favorite finds for the year? Any surprises, good or bad? And, boys, is there anything you are looking for in 2017? So, Carrington, what was your favorite find for 2016?
I was going to say nothing, because I really had to think, did I acquire anything or anything that I was really keen on? I really don't like having a lot of stuff. And so for me, a good year is when I end up with less stuff than I had before. Play the games, get rid of them, that sort of thing. I just don't want to get burdened down with a lot of ballast. But then looking over my receipts, it turns out I did acquire something that I adore and is retro-related. So hooray for that. So wasn't really a find so much as just I went online and I purchased it. But from A2Heaven.com, great site, great products, I dig them, I purchased the RAMworks 3 VGA extender. Because I already had a RAMworks 3 card for my Apple IIe. This thing, the VGA extender, is amazing. It was, I think, $75, clicks into the RAMworks 3, and you have perfect, amazing, super fast VGA output from your Apple II. It's seamless. It was amazing. It plugged it in, worked immediately, has given me no issues. I have attached multiple modern LCD monitors to it, a VGA to HDMI converter cable, and everything works. Everything I've thrown at it works perfectly. I no discernible lag in playing games. All the colors look perfectly fine to my eye. There's little switches that you can adjust whether you get little lines and stuff. I don't know. I just plugged it in and it works. And it's just one of those beautifully made, perfectly implemented, amazing value for its money. Now, the downside is you need a RAMworks 3 card, which is itself a little difficult to acquire. If you have one of those, though, I cannot strong enough recommend how amazing the A2Heaven VGA extender is. Now, they also make a standalone VGA card, which I believe has come and gone very quickly and sells out immediately on the A2Heaven site because everybody wants something like that. I would assume it works just as well. I don't know. But if you have a RAMworks 3, and it's got to be a 3, can't be the other ones, but if you have a RAMworks 3, get the VGA extender. It's amazing. It's the best $75 you could spend. I love it. So I acquired that this year, and it was a total game changer. So hooray for that. One thing.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good piece. Yeah, I've actually got a few pieces of A2Heaven kit for my machines. My favorite of those is the Apple IIc video to VGA. So I can just plug the box into the back of the IIc. And again, I just plug it into an LCD monitor. And that LCD monitor right beside me is actually one of my favorite acquisitions of the year. So I'm just going to jump in on here. It's actually a 19-inch 4:3 ratio LCD monitor. So no pillar boxing. Hook it up to my retro machines, and it is just a great monitor. So a little bit difficult to find the 19-inch LCD screens these days, I find. You can still pick up 15s quite easily. There's lots of 17-inch 4:3 ratio monitors, but I was very happy to pick up the 19.
I should add something. I was just checking that I had the price correct on the RAMworks 3 VGA extender. So I went to the store, and yes, it's $75, $85, and in stock right now, but nobody seems to have announced it, is the standard Apple II VGA scaler card. So at the moment of us recording, you could go to the A2Heaven.com site and pick up a VGA card for your Apple II for $85. And I don't know when those got back in stock, but I suspect they will be out of stock again as soon as anybody hears about it. But if not, go check the site. But at the moment, the people recording the show have the option to purchase one.
I just might. I'm loading it now.
Yes. As I said, they're great. And I know a few people who have the Apple II video card, and they all love it. And it supports such a, almost the entire range of the 8-bit Apple II machines. So, right now, I believe I've seen one running in a Euro Plus. Obviously, no problem for a 2E, but yeah. So, while Paul is making some online purchases, my favorite acquisition of the year was the Microsi Havoc, a 6502 machine that purports to be Apple II compatible, or in brackets 80%. At the moment, I'm finding that it is somewhat less than 80% of the titles that I've got, but I think the main problem is that I seem to have misplaced my DOS 3.3 system master, so I can actually load FP Basic, so I can actually use it a bit more. But the important thing is it arrived from the US well packaged. Nothing's broken, everything works, and went and got myself a little step-down transformer because this poor little thing can only handle half-strength electricity, and plugged it in after we gave it an inspection, and it's a nice, nice machine. It's a little bit on the ugly side, but it's nice. In the non-hardware side, I've got two items that I picked up during the year. The first one, thanks to Paul, was the IBM 360 souvenir press release kit for the Apollo 11 launch. And that is a lovely piece of space memorabilia. So I've still got that on my to-be-scanned pile, so I can just share it with everybody. And just recently, I picked up a ring binder from a VZ200 enthusiast. And it contained all these magazine articles, photocopies of magazine articles from back in the 80s, and also a 3 photocopied manuals. So they've been blown up to A4 size instead of the down at the A5 size. So a little bit easier for my old eyes to read. But what I like about all these old copies and things is that it's the margin notes that you find in there, the little bits of extra that someone's written in even if it's, say, in the magazine articles, it's an addenda. So there's been a correction to a listing. So the person has just gone and updated the listing, made a little note there that that's come out of another issue. They've put a few little notes as to problems they found and what they wanted to do. So I find it a great little snapshot into the retro hobby when you pick up, it's a copy. You could find the magazines online, but there's just that little something about having something that's been annotated by a fellow enthusiast. So they're the three items I think that I like the most for 2016. The most surprising one, I suppose, is back to the folder of articles, because I just bought it mainly for the manuals, but the articles, they were a surprise bonus. Oh, they were listed in the eBay auction, but it's just that, again, just that window as to what was actually out in mainstream magazines for here in Australia for the VZ200 and the VZ300, which are quite nice little machines. So, Paul, amongst all your acquisitions for 2016, what would be your one standout acquisition?
And is it a VGA card?
Well,
that's, no, that's if it arrives within the next 2 weeks. So.
Yeah, no, I haven't. Was not quite able to make it through the checkout process, so I'll have to go back to that. But so just one. I didn't realize that was going to be the requirement. I think probably kind of going along maybe with the theme that you started with your, what was it, the Havoc? Mm. I got a Micro Professor 2, which is a similar kind of almost Apple II compatible little computer and weird looking little thing. It's got a keyboard. It's got, I guess you call it a Chiclet keyboard, but it's a very weird, not very pleasant keyboard to type on, and it's just a little box. It looks kind of like a modem, in a way, like one of those external modems that you could get.
Oh, I remember those. The U.S. Robotics had that kind of shape modem, I think.
Yeah. What is the one I have? Multitech was the one that I have in my head when I say that. It's which was just the one that we happened to use at where I worked back in the relevant day, but. So the Micro Professor 2, I haven't played it around with it very much. It's Apple compatible in probably the Havoc way, which is kind of, but it is 6502 and it has a certain amount of familiarity, to me. So I'm kind of looking forward to playing with it. I haven't done very much with it, but I got a pretty complete set. I found it on Craigslist and, I wrote to the guy and said, yeah, I'm sort of interested in this, and it turned out he was moving. He had a kind of a house full of stuff he'd been hanging on to. And so I had that. And, I forget if I mentioned this before, when this actually happened, when was this? I forget now exactly when this was, but, so there were a couple of Sony News workstations, which were these, big Unix machines in a laptop form, and some Newton stuff. And, it was a pretty amazing catch overall. But I think of those things, the thing that I was kind of most impressed by was the Micro Professor 2. So maybe I'll stick with that.
Yeah, like you, I like the oddball machines, and that was one of the reasons I went with the Havoc, is that there's so little information about them out there on the web. So I'm currently trawling through a whole pile of links, so I want to try and build up, at least for other people, some more information about it. And most of what I've found online is really just press releases saying it's available, this is its cost, and then sort of saying what it can do. And I would really just love to get the system disks that came with it so that I wouldn't have to rely on using it as an Apple compatible. Rather, I'd be able to use it as itself, a very nice to use 6502 based machine. Styling's a bit on the strange and ugly side, though one person did comment that the external floppy drive, you could put a pair of nacelles on it and it would look like the shuttle out of Star Trek.
Excellent.
Yep.
Though so would most things if you put a pair of nacelles on them.
Oh, I'll post up a picture to the Facebook group of the actual external hard drive so people can have a look. But unlike the MicroProfessor, this has actually come with a very good keyboard. It's as far as all of my retro machines, I would say it's the most enjoyable to use keyboard. Again, it's a custom-built keyboard, but it's got lovely key movements on it, and of course it's a nice clicky keyboard, so going to open that up at some stage and see if I can identify the key switches in it, because it's definitely a nice piece of kit.
Yeah, no, you can dump the ROM so that we can all emulate it in mess.
Yeah, I think most of them are soldered on to the board. I'll have to go and see. I don't feel like unsoldering them, but anything that is socketed, I've taken some photos, but I'm definitely going to open it up and get the good camera out and, as I said, get some documentation for this thing done. But,
yeah. Well, and I would think actually for a lot of the data that would be on the ROMs, it's accessible from within the machine. I mean, like, it's on the address bus, so you could probably just read it and save it somewhere.
Well, there's something else for me to learn to do. It's always something new and something to learn with these computers. I've come from primarily a programming background, so getting in and playing with the hardware is always a learning experience.
Well, and actually, there's another kind of retro aspect to that, and you know, for both of these machines, you know, the one that I have and the one that you have, that it's a little bit like the world pre-internet, because there's no information.
That's right.
You can Google all you want.
Yeah,
so all
that
is, yourself.
All that really that I'm finding is sort of like Google diving into magazine scans. So like takes you to a link back to a text version of a creative computer magazine, or a mention of in a magazine inside Google Books. But there's, as you said, it's pre-internet. There's no information about it. And that is one of the problems with collecting, because I get the feeling that people go, oh, I wonder what that is. And then they go and Google it. They don't find anything. And they then just say, oh, well, don't know, chuck it.
Yeah.
But they should chuck it at Paul.
Yes. One of my biggest fears is that because there's no information out on the stranger machines, like this one says it's a serial number. I think it's like it's in the low thousands of the total build, and I think this one comes from just over 1,000. So there weren't many of them made, and I suspect there's not many of them left. Oh, well, maybe I will find some discs and manuals for it in 2017. That's my goal. My one main goal for 2017 is to get my hands on anything extra on the MicroSci Havoc. So if anyone out there has anything, drop me a line.
I think I have this vague recollection. I can't remember exactly what the context of this was, but I think long time ago on our very podcast, I think we had a MicroSci Havoc and like the auction picks or something. Somehow there was a comment. I'll have to check my email, because it's possible that it was just something, you know, rather than in a public forum, and that it was something in my email or something. But I'm pretty sure that the person who posted, like, her father worked for MicroSci and got this as part of just being in the company, and it's possible that there might be a contact person that might know someone who knows someone. But so maybe I'll just cut all that out. But at any rate,
yeah. So anything in particular that you're looking for in 2017? So Paul, not counting the VGA card for the Apple IIe that you're currently trying to purchase online, he says, distracting him. Is there anything in particular that you're looking for 2017, as opposed to, you know, later on in next year you can tell us what you've tripped across, but is there anything in particular that you're looking for, that you're intently looking for, and maybe our listeners might give you some leads or something?
Ah, that's a good question. Yeah, I mean, I was going to answer in a sort of flippant way and say I'm looking for, things that are currently buried in my office. But so
it has to be an achievable goal.
Yeah, right, exactly. And yeah, right, that would be more like 2019, I think. But
I love the idea of one of those Atari landfill documentaries, but just filmed in Paul's office.
Yeah, no, actually, I mean, the problem has been you know, there's enough stuff here that I forget, okay, sometimes what I already have. And so, and actually, I have yet to do this, but it is sometimes tempting to just buy another one, you know, because I don't know where the one that I do have is. But yeah, no, I don't know. I do sort of feel like I'm getting close to having achieved many of the things that are achievable in terms of getting things, you know. So I actually just maybe a week ago or something, I got a Commodore 128, which I was one of the things I thought it would be nice to have, and now I have one. I have a Coco 3. I don't have a Lisa 1, but I don't expect I ever will. Yeah, no, I think what I am hoping to find is basically just the time to deal with what I already have.
Which, of course, will be impacted by when you trip across something else that's interesting.
Right.
Okay, Carrington, 2017, what would you like to get, play, and then put back out?
Well, I'm looking forward to the arrival of the VGA card I just purchased. Beach Ball, though they are still available. And that's one of those things where something like that, like an adapter card or whatever, that's the kind of thing I will buy, even if I don't need, like, I have no need for that. But they're not going to be made forever. And it's so small to just throw one of those in a baggie and store them in a bin someplace. That's the kind of thing I will pick up and just have. I don't really consider it collecting so much as just acquiring just in case. It's just a good rule. Something like that is available, you just get one. But to be perfectly honest, there is nothing else I want to purchase. There are some Infocom games I don't have, so I might want to pick up those. And every once in a while, I'll see a new game for the Apple II that looks like it would be really fun to have and to play, but temporarily. But honestly, if I end next year with less stuff than I have now, I will honestly be happy. I started this year with more retro computers than I have at the moment because I, at the beginning of the year, had a 2C and an Apple IIc, and I no longer do, and I'm happy about that. So I'm down one. And I would like to narrow down my Apple II collection. Right now I have a 2E and a 2GS, and that seems excessive. So I really got to pick between the two, I think. And I suspect the 2GS will be maybe contributed to Kansas Fest, and I have an Atari 800, and so those, and an LC-475. See, like, just that's too many things. So something else has got to go. But honestly, there is nothing I'd like to pick up. If I get anything, I hopefully will be replacing something. Like, pick up a new monitor so you get rid of an old monitor. I don't want to have more stuff. I want to live in a van down by the river. I don't want to own a lot of things. I want to be able to move into Paul's office, and he doesn't even notice I'm there. That's my goal.
Right.
I may be there now, Paul. You don't know. You don't know. So when the VGA adapter shows up, make sure you read the label carefully to see whether it's yours or mine. But my honest answer is I don't want to acquire anything. I keep acquiring things because things are tempting and I have nostalgia for them and they are fun. But stuff is ballast and I don't want a lot of it. So that's my answer. Less stuff.
In case you need to flee at a moment's notice.
Exactly. You don't know my lifestyle. Don't judge me.
Okay.
How about you, Michael?
As I said, I'm actually tending towards the Carrington perspective, but
yes.
I can't see it happening, really. Yeah. Really, the only thing which I'm actively going to be looking for is more information about the microsci, and I'm also going to concentrate a bit more on the VZ300, the Dick Smith VZ300. It's a nice little machine, proper keyboard, unlike the 200, which is one of those chiclet keyboard things. So I've picked up a few more manuals for it, some ROMs, packs for it, but now that I've got one of those little night owl security monitors, I can easily move that between the various machines, so I can get that set up and just get in and using it. It comes with a cassette player branded for the VZ range, but it's been a long time since I've serviced a cassette player, so I'm probably just going to use a little music player and just put the cassettes. Most of them seem to be downloadable as WAV files, so I just put them onto a music player and just play them in. But Apart from bits for the 300 and documentation for the Havoc, I think that's more than enough to concentrate on. I'm sure I'll trip across other interesting things, but this 2017, I think I'll just try and keep it a little bit more under control. But
so basically, I think we are all saying basically the same thing, right? Like we're all overwhelmed with what we already have.
Yep. Although a cassette player is handy, like stuff like you were just talking about, like having a cassette player, unlike say a disk drive, a cassette can go and be used on multiple retro computers, and so that's cool. And say we have a single monitor can. Do you use a switcher for your like monitor, say like the Night Owl, or do you just like sneaker net the cable around?
Well, it's got two inputs, so at the moment,
fancy.
I'm going to be setting up a spot for the VZ300, and I can just power up the Night Owl and choose between AV1 and AV2 and nice. Just see how it goes. But
also the cassette player, if 2017 is the year, fingers crossed that the single makes a revival, then you're ready to go.
You mean all those people who get tired of vinyl and go back to cassette? Yes.
Oh, did I mention last time that I got an episode of a podcast on vinyl? No Such Thing as a Fish has an episode, a special vinyl version.
That's amazing.
But
I approve. That's pretty cool. Awesome.
But I was going to say the thing that scares me about cassette players is that more than most of the other equipment that I've got, these are the things that have the little rubber wheels that can degrade.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, like if you put a tape in it, it could just cover it with goop.
Oh, good point.
Which is not so great.
Oh, no, you've definitely got to give them a good check out before you use them. Even if it's one that you've used in the past, the rubber capstan rollers, they can degrade. The heads, that there's quite a lot of moving parts in a cassette player.
You should have I think it's called an SNC, sacrificial Nickelback cassette, which you throw in. You just make sure everything's working fine. Everyone should have an SNC or two around, just for testing.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's one of the reasons why I've specifically ordered a small audio player. Just comes with 8 gigabyte built in, so I can just put the cassettes that are available to download. And most brands of computers, the cassettes are available as WAV files. Just select the track and hit play. It's a great cassette substitute. The only downside is that if you've got a cassette with your own programs on it, at some stage you've got to get a cassette player working so that you can unload your programs or programs that you find for tapes, and so that you can use it. But as I said, it's been a long time since I've serviced a cassette player, and I think even the spare bands and wheels and things that I've got have probably aged. So it's going to be interesting. Well, that's 2016 out of the way, but wait, there could be some more.
Oh, yeah. So for those who are listening as we release these, this is of interest. For those who are listening to the backlog from a year ago, who cares? But at any rate, we were not around last week, and the previous one to this took a little while to post because we had some problems with our hosting site, and I'm not sure that they're actually solved, but there is a workaround such that we can get this episode out. So because you're listening to this now, it's I guess we can say it's working.
Unless, of course, they've downloaded it from an alter source. But
pirate RCR.
Yeah. Well, you've got the mic
should
there.
Should I keep going?
Anything else from our listeners?
Yeah, well, so there are a couple things just to mention. So Tony wrote to point out the existence of Atari ST magazine that is now out called Atari Crypt. I know very little about this, but we are linking to the article. It says that it is it is full of 16-bit gaming goodness, and it is free, although they accept donations. But my impression of this is that it is intended to be the first issue of many. So if you want to check out the Atari Crypt magazine, there is a link there, ataricrypt.blogspot.ca. So thanks, Tony. Douglas on Facebook pointed out a video about Bill Busby's Magic One, which is a home-built mini computer of some sort, built completely of TTL chips. So there's a video on YouTube that kind of introduces this TTL CPU, 10 years of magic. And so in April 2014, he posted this, you know, sort of described this thing that started working in April 2004. So hence the 10 years of magic. By now, I guess, what is it, 12? But this looks kind of familiar to me. Like, I think I've seen this video, but I couldn't find it in our own archives. So I don't know if we ever linked to it before, whatever, you will have forgotten it by now. So go watch it again. but it is kind of long. So it's 56 minutes long, which means I have only just sort of bookmarked it myself. I have yet to rewatch it. Does this look familiar at all to anyone? Or is this just me?
Yeah, well, as you said, there's something familiar about it being made totally from TTL chips, but still very interesting. So again, I'm with you. I've bookmarked that one to have a look at later on. But really, it's someone's built in recent times a computer based on a retro way of doing it, and it's been done so long ago that it's now actually a retro computer itself.
Yeah.
Well, ish. Yep.
Right. I anticipate we will talk more about that in the future.
I'm sure we'll always be talking about that in the future.
Right. And then the last thing is that on the Facebook page, Charles mentioned that he had dumped some ROMs from an LNW80 kit computer. It's not a computer I'm familiar with, but I guess a TRS-80 clone had different ROMs in its own version of Level 2 BASIC, and so he's dumped the ROMs, put them on archive.org, so you can take a look at that if you know something about the LNW80 kit computer. I think Charles is looking for information as well, but I didn't sort of take note of this, but I remember seeing him posting on the Facebook group also that he's managed to work out a way to dump a particular kind of ROM that it's a little bit harder to dump than most. And so he's basically worked out a workflow to do this. So I think you can contact him to find out how to do it, or maybe he will accept things to dump for you. I don't know. But at any rate, you can check the Facebook group. That's maybe a bit of encouragement to go visit us there.
I think we should guarantee that he will accept things, and he'll gladly do them, and he'll pay the postage both ways.
Yep, that sounds about
right. And throw in a little something extra for you. I say that's a guarantee from RCR to you on behalf of Charles. You guys love it when I'm on the show.
Yep.
Yeah, well, I'm sure Charles will have many words of encouragement regarding that.
That's what they're called, words of encouragement. I get those a lot.
Okay. Well, that's all pretty interesting. But speaking of interesting, hey, Carrington, you've got something rare.
I don't have it.
You don't? I thought the way you've written this, that you actually, this was yours. You know,
yes.
Part of, you know, sell something, buy something.
Charles gave it to me. Sure, why not? 367,000 pounds. It's not a weight. It's a money, and it's a big money. It's very expensive. So it is a rare World War II Enigma machine that sold at auction. Now, all the Enigma machines are rare, but this is rare even with those. And the Daily Mirror, your trusted source for news, says it's a rare World War II Enigma machine used to defeat Hitler. That's an important part for them to throw in case people hadn't heard of World War II. But sold for a record price. It is an M4 version of it. I did not realize, really, that there were multiple versions of the Enigma. I guess I kind of knew there were multiple versions, but I didn't really know they were kind of in categories and stuff. And so this is an M4, which means it's a four-rotor one, came a little later, I think 1942, something like that. So it took them a while to crack that extra rotor. It's neat looking, looks totally complete. And it's nice to look at these, mostly because it will remind you what they look like. So should you ever be at a flea market or up in an attic or something, and you see something that looks like one of those, be aware and give it to me. Is the message, is the takeaway. So sold for a bunch of money, super clean looking, super neat looking. I love the Enigma machines. I like encrypting and cracking stuff in general. And there's about 120 of these, I think, known to have existed. And so they're super desirable. And this one was highly desired by somebody. So sold for a pretty penny. Very, very pretty.
Highly desired by two people, probably.
Yeah, highly desired by more than one person, which is the key to auction pricing. So yeah, we'll have links to that and a link to a site explaining the various sorts of Enigma machines, and it'll jump you right to the M4 in case you want to know what made this one special. It defeated Hitler!
Yep, and then from there you can link over to my favourite British site, the Bletchley Park, and let's see what the British did to actually crack the Enigma encoding, which is great, because effectively it was analog encryption being defeated by digital computing. So a battle on both sides.
The M4 also goes between London and South Wales. Apparently.
Right, and was used, therefore, to crack that encryption. Yeah. Really big encryption.
Okay. Well, also on the slow computing side, I've got a link here to an Atari 2600 emulator. Now, big deal. But this one...
next topic.
This one is actually in Minecraft. And what I like about it, it is vanilla Minecraft. There's no add-ons or anything. It is just straight... pure Minecraft. The downside of that is that when you use it to play one of the ROMs, the refresh rate is so slow that you can only watch the games being played in time lapse. So here's a link to the Ars Technica article and a link to a YouTube video, but it has an astounding 20 instructions per second for its processing. So I think the 2600 is somewhere up around the 500,000 instructions per second. So the emulator is just lagging a little bit. But
it's still pretty impressive, though. Anybody that can do these things with people build like working machines and emulators and computers inside Minecraft, every time I don't even use Minecraft, and I am shockingly impressed that people actually do this. So very well done, regardless of the speed.
Yeah, and I watched the video a little bit, and I watched as a line got drawn, and then another line got drawn, and I thought, all right, I'm skipping ahead. but my experience with Minecraft is entirely like spinning around and digging myself into a hole, and then quitting the application. I have no idea how to use the thing.
Well, actually, this person has only taken that concept of yours and just developed it a little bit further, and 2600 emulator.
Yeah. Oh, perfect.
Well, that whole chasing the beam thing, I guess now you can just sort of do it as a slow stroll.
Yeah, right. You can go build a little house or whatever you do and then come back.
The problem is every evening the whole thing is destroyed. Oh, it's the middle of a game, and then these monsters showed up. Ah, not enough torches on my Apple or my Atari 2600.
Yeah. No, the other thing is that I even find a lot of the games too fast, too hard to play, and...
It's a Vin Diesel movie. Too fast, too hard to play.
Yep. So I thought, I'll just have a look at this, and now that's so slow that I can't play it. But I'm gonna have to find something which maybe try and get an emulator that so I can actually force it to run at half or quarter speed, so I can actually play these games. Just a little bit on the eye-hand coordination is lacking.
I'm sure that they exist.
I'm sure they do. Okay, so Paul, have you got something that maybe I can handle?
Well, it's not gonna be too fast for you, but. This is kind of a little interesting proof of concept kind of thing. Let's see, who is it?
Vince.
I had his name.
Yeah, Vince Weaver.
Yes, Vince Weaver. Created a web server in AppleSoft Basic. So on an Apple IIe, and so there's a step that is important to say, which is that all of the Ethernet stuff is handled by a card, the Ethernet 2 card. But what he did here was basically just using, Basic and a few pokes, set up something that would actually listen for a web request and serve HTTP. And they did a little demo video that shows this in action. And you can watch as it's unbelievably slow, actually. I mean, I guess it's because it's written in Basic and Basic is interpreted, and it could, I think this could be done actually relatively quickly if you were to write it in assembly language. But this, what's interesting about this is that this is an actual working web server written in BASIC. You know, it, the actual whatever it is TCP IP is handled by the Ethernet 2 card with a W5100 chip on it. But you know, the actual like sort of like parsing of the requests and serving of the pages happens through the use of AppleSoft and, you know, reading the whatever the ping file off the disk and sending it out and stuff. It's I don't know if you have watched the video. This, I actually did sit through the video, although I was very tempted to do the same thing as I did with the Minecraft video and skip ahead. But I watched it as the characters drew, you know, line by line across the screen, and eventually the sample web page showed up on the modern machine that was connecting to it. So I don't know. Have you guys taken a look at this?
I have, and I was really impressed. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone who's interested in internet capabilities on Apple II should check this out, because it's another great example with the source code you can get that shows you, okay, how did he interact with the Ethernet, which is doing, like you say, all the heavy lifting, because all the socket stuff is just handled by that. But how does one interact with it? And this is the first thing I've ever seen interacting with it in BASIC. So super cool, and I think a good example of stuff, and well worth checking out.
Yep, and there's the challenge. Shall we see a web server written in BASIC for other machines that have the availability of an Ethernet card?
You say other, but you mean lesser, correct? Let's be accurate with our
But no, there was a few comments in there about how, you know, people thought that, you know, it wasn't a, you know, a fair simulation because it was using modern hardware. But, you know, we're talking about machines that were end of life, really end of life, either at the beginning of the internet age or even end of life before it. So I still think it is a great example of using hardware into the machine, and it is still the, in this case, the Apple II dealing with what it needs to do to be a HTTP server. It is, you know, okay, yes, the card is considerably younger than the machine, but we're not talking about serially connecting a Raspberry Pi or something else and just using the Apple as, you know, just the keyboard interface or anything along those lines, or just a terminal to something which is, you know, more modern than doing all the heavy lifting. This is an application written in the native language of the machine, interfacing with the hardware in the machine, and it is working within a modern day environment, albeit very slowly. But you know, as you said, it's an interpretive BASIC. It's probably pushing the boundaries of what you can do in BASIC with this, but I think it's an excellent, excellent example of a retro computer sitting up, waving its hand about, and saying, me too, I can live in this modern world. Just don't want it to do it too fast. It'll get there in the end.
Well, I think, you know, Carrington's point about, you know, the fact that this is in BASIC and we have the source available to us, you know, that also really does kind of, even if you, you know, kind of wanted to do this and you wanted to write it in machine language or something, starting with BASIC gives you something accessible to look at and say, oh, okay, I see what it's doing. Now I'll try to make it faster.
A lot of the time, a lot of the time I found that you didn't need to rewrite the entire thing in assembler. You know, it could just be that there could be one or two critical routines that if written in assembler and then just called from within the BASIC program would give it all the extra speed that it needs. It's the way that a lot of us did our programming back in the day. You know, quickly get it going, as you said, write it in BASIC, get it going, then find out where it can be improved. And that is usually a lot faster than writing the whole thing in assembler from scratch. And even if you do, it is great to have a working example that you can then say, okay, fine, now I will write it in assembler. And you can select, compare the two, make sure it's doing the right thing. But no, I think it's a great little exercise, and congratulations, Vince. That was a great little project. Okay, Carrington. It's ice cream time.
Cool.
What?
Yeah. Well, he's got a scoop.
Oh. I love things that let us scoop the Open Apple podcast. That's the whole reason for the existence of the RCR, frankly, is to scoop Open Apple. And so I think we're still in time to do that with this. Love a scoop. Buckshot, so created by Dagan Brock, is an image converter for Apple II images. So it's cross-platform, Mac, Linux, Windows, and it lets you convert graphics into Apple II formats for 2GS and otherwise. You can pick, like, do you want HDR or whatever and what resolution your target is, and you open up one graphic and get to save it out. So if you're looking to convert graphics, bingo, Dagan has made an amazing tool. Now, he built it on top of an existing, I think it's command line tool, BMP to DHR, it's called. But still, this is great, and it's graphical, and makes it super easy, especially the Mac side, which you just download a DMG and just, like, drag the finished application into your applications folder, and you're done. So if you're looking to convert Apple II files, this is amazing. Now, lots of caveats. He calls it a toy. He says it's super buggy. And it is. In fact, it is version 0.00. So that should set some expectations. And yet, I used it, and it worked flawlessly. So there's at least one instance of this working great. And I think it's fantastic. Dagan's done an amazing job. It's got a great website. I think it's an exciting tool. And so people just we're going to have it in the show links, the show notes. And it's a great thing to be aware of. There will come a point where you want to convert graphics. It's happened to me a few times. And so just being aware that these tools exist is amazing. So this is something definitely worth adding to your bookmarks, even if you're a little shy of using a 0.00 version of something. I think it's fantastic. I love the fact that it exists for multiple operating systems. It's totally free. Dagan does great work. Hooray for Dagan. And I think it's fantastic. So I'm really pleased to have links to it. I'm super pleased to be scooping Open Apple about it. That's the best part of all of this. And I'm just a happy Carrington. That's what I'm saying.
That's cool. That's really, I hadn't tried this before, but as you were talking, I downloaded it and I'm now making previews of little photos of a manual that I happen to have, you know, around.
Isn't it great? It's so easy to use.
It's cool.
It's remarkably easy just because it's all graphical. Just open your file, set your target, what you'd like it to be, and then click a button and it even shows you a little preview. It's remarkably well done.
And I can sort of see, like, if you were going to try to do something like an adventure game or something like that, it might actually be pretty handy to rather than sit there and, you know, fiddle with individual pixels, just take the photo of the thing you want.
Yeah, and also I have done that because I've worked on little Apple II games, and that's how you normally do it. You sort of, I draw down on graph paper first and then figure out everything, and it's much easier to do something like this. And please give it over for me in a format I can just, like, load. So I dig it. I dig it very much. I think this is going to be super handy going forward. And that's the scoop.
Okay. Well, as much as I said, I like my Apple computers, I'm falling in love with my VZ300, here is a link to, I think, another machine which I'm starting to fall in love with. So it is a restoration of an Australian-built IBM 5160. So it is had a bit of a harrowing life. So it started its day from an Adelaide Hills quarry covered in limestone dust. It was a few dents and a few scratches, some corrosion. I'll link to the forum where it is on display. And when you see the before photos, it's literally choked with dust. So Mike has stripped it down. He even had the chassis sandblasted and then resprayed, and even just the resprayed chassis is beautiful. It is a great article over at it's called Restoring an Australian Classic. It's in the garage section of the Apple Talk forum. So it is a excellent series of before and after photos, and he took it and showed it at the Adelaide Retro Computing end of year barbecue and exhibit just recently.
I have questions.
Cool. You have questions?
I do. I have questions.
you are an enigma.
Ratney. First of all, this is gorgeous. And you're right. Even the photo of the chassis, I was like, that is already more beautiful than anything I've ever made in my life. And the effort other people would put in to restore stuff is, I'm so happy other people do stuff like this. It's great. My question is this. So this is an Australian made 5160.
Yes.
Was that like a separate thing just because of the power? Or for all I know, all 5160s and like were made in Australia at the time. And I never knew that about IBM. Like what's going on here?
Okay. Well, in the 90s.
Plus, it's fun to say Wangaratta. Is that where this
Wangaratta,
was made?
Wangaratta is where it was made. Okay.
Australian
government,
words are great.
Yeah. Government contracts back then, even today, required a component of basically Australian built. Now, I would strongly suspect that it's heavily assembled at Wangaratta. There might be some metalwork that's done locally, but there had to be a certain component of Australian built to get the federal government contracts. So, you know, that was basically supposedly to increase jobs and skilling of Australians. I believe the same plant actually assembled cards for various manufacturers. Apart from Apple memory cards and a few others were also done at Wangaratta. I'm trying to remember, apart from the IBM stuff that was there. But it was basically to ensure a minimum Australian content for the services contract that IBM would have been winning. Or cool. Bidding for.
Nice. I've always had a soft spot for the IBM, like the ATs and the XTs, like that era of giant metal heavy desktops. I just think I like the look of them. They are their own beast. I think they make really fun gaming machines. So like I applaud this all around. Like I think they are a fantastic. I mean, at the time I was very anti IBM, but now that I've mellowed so much, as you can tell, I dig them. I dig them very. I don't want one, but I really like them. They're fun to look at.
There's somewhere down the blog post, there's a screenshot of a surface scan of Drive C, and so it's got a little track map. And
yes.
I was just looking at this and thinking, you know, I really kind of like that IBM font and that, you know, the way they managed to get graphical representations out of the font and stuff like that. There's something, you can tell that it's an IBM that you're looking at. It's very kind of distinctive, in a way that I find pleasing.
I completely agree.
But some of those before shots, it definitely wasn't the computer that you wanted to plug in and power up until it had been somewhat cleaned. The amount of dust that's sitting in there, I'm actually surprised that it's come up to be such a beautiful working machine. But
there was a high chance of explosion. It'd be one of those things where, like, if it was a mobster's computer, you would have had like a low person go and start it up. Go start up the PC.
Yeah.
Boom. I may not know how mobs work.
And they connected a very yellow keyboard to it, though.
Yeah, the most hideous keyboard. The monitor is okay, I guess, with the wrong aspect ratio. But then they've got this crazily awful yellow. Like, why? Oh, my goodness. So bad.
Yeah. Well, it makes it look better in comparison, right?
Yes, because, the case of the computer itself looks pristine. Looks like it was just made yesterday.
Yes, I think that keyboard is just screaming out for a little bit of retro brighting, because I don't think that's the original color.
Yeah.
So we'll include that in our links, and also a link to I think it's a 1992 TV advertisement, or more of a brand awareness that IBM did of their Wangaratta plant. Okay, Paul, I'll let you take the next one.
Okay, so I barely know what this is, but I have a link to it. So I will tell you what it is called. It is called ASM80.com. I can tell you sort of what it is. I actually have not successfully used it, but it's basically an assembler in your browser. So it handles assembler code for 8-bit processors, mainly the 8080, 8085, Z80, and 6502. And it's basically an entire, like, integrated development environment. It'll save files, whatever you think of as files in your cookie space, I guess, basically, you know, it saves it in your browser. So you can create a new file. You can, they have a couple of demos. So there's a snake game written in 6502. And so you can click on that and it will add to your workspace. And then you can look at the source code and, it'll compile it, assemble it. And then it has a number of emulators. So ZX Spectrum, SVC 6809, SVC Z80, and you know, whatever. I don't know. I don't know exactly what the interface capabilities of these generic 6809, Z80, 6502 machines are. There's a KIM-1, and then a couple other things I don't know. But it's kind of cool. I mean, it's a pretty serious editing environment that it just runs in your browser. So, so if you wanted to quickly do some assembly, you know, I can call up the snake game in 6502 and then, see what it's doing. You know, I can see its start direction, start length, you know, it gives instructions on how the keys are supposed to work. What I have yet to be able to do is actually what I wanted to do was compile it and then run it in the emulator. And there's a little compile button you can hit, okay. It has compiled it, emulator F10, but then I don't know what happens. So I can't quite tell what's happening at this point. So so I haven't mastered this yet, but I do think it's kind of cool. And it is also cool that it handles a number of processors. So anyway.
It's cool. There's a few online assemblers like for the 6502, but this is the first one I've seen that is a like pick your processor, set up your system. Like this one, you say, how much memory do you have? What's your column size and stuff? And what's your processor? And then you start. So that's neat. So that definitely sets it apart.
Yeah. What I want to do is find a demo video showing it in use so that I can actually do something with it. Because I think I would give it a try at least. But anyway.
No, I like it because it lets you dabble in other CPUs so that you can actually, without going to all the trouble of setting up IDE workflow and everything for something that you're not familiar with. So it's a great little tool for just sort of like putting your toes in the water, just seeing how it goes, and then you know, if you want to take up the line, so if you want to do some Z80 work, you know, try it out, see how it goes, and then get serious on your own machine. I think it's a great way of getting started, and just a good way of just trying something out. Okay, Anne Carrington, you've got a very interesting one about Steve.
I do, and like ice cream, what's better than a scoop? Two scoops.
Two scoops.
Hear me, Open Apple. Two scoops. So there's a great article out there called Steve Wozniak Was My Computer Teacher in 1995, which sounds like a 1950s movie. You know, my computer teacher was a werewolf or whatever. But this is very similar to that. But in this case, instead of a werewolf, it was Steve Wozniak. Hard to tell them apart. So this person went to a very small school in Silicon Valley in 1995, 30 students in grade 5. And the parents of the students would contribute and do things and come in and pitch in. And it was that sort of neighborhood. So one of the students, Sarah, her dad agreed to teach them about computers because her dad was, and I buried the lead here, Steve Wozniak. So this is an article about that experience, having Steve Wozniak as your fifth grade computer teacher and what he was like and what they did. And one of the things he did was show up and give them all laptops and say, there, if you learn what I teach you, then you'll get to keep your power. It was a PowerBook 1400C. And there's some great photos. And the article's great. You should definitely read it. It's really interesting. But I found, as is often the case, the most fun was in the photos. So you see these very staged photos of the kids. There's one with Wozniak smiling and sort of marching and all the kids marching behind him. He's like the Pied Piper, and that's a very disturbing sort of image. And he's sort of playing the laptops. And I can see the kids are holding these things. And these are 6-7 pound laptops. Right? So these little, they're all smiling, but I bet you this had to be taken really quickly. And none of them show the screens turned on. There's also some photos of them sitting outside on a park bench or something, and he's teaching, and it doesn't show the screens there. And I suspect none of these, because This is back when you'd get a good half an hour out of these laptops. But it's really neat.
And you couldn't see the screen in the sunlight.
Absolutely. So it's very fancy. Yeah,
so why bother turning it on?
Yeah, so let's all go outside and sit there as if it's working, and then I'll go back inside and plug them all in. But still, how cool would that have been? And I bet you he was an engaging, interesting teacher. And it's one of those experiences the kids would look back on and go, I really didn't appreciate it at the time, as children are about everything. So mostly, I mean, the main reason I wanted to direct everyone's attention to it was, though, it was probably a chance to scoop open Apple a second time. And boy, this show is just pleasing me so much. So there you go. Steve Wozniak was my computer teacher in 1995. Definitely worth a gander.
Yeah, as you said, I love the photos. Okay. That's about it for the news that's out there. So with 2016 rapidly coming to a close, here's an ad from our sponsor.
In 1984, IBM began making personal computers at one of the world's most exotic spots.
IBM.
IBM personal computer.
공짜탐나이 아메리카.
마이차이 마이차이.
탐나이 왕가라타.
왕가라타.
Australia.
Oh, Australia.
In 1993, IBM will earn export revenue of over $200 million for Australia from our Wangaratta plant. IBM is a major employer at Wangaratta and Australia's largest exporter of computer equipment. We're especially proud that since this computer was made in 1984, we've added one more name to the great centres of technology, Wangaratta, Australia.
Wangaratta.
And we're back. So, there's a new film on in town. And some of us have seen it, and some of us haven't. And some of us have seen it more than once. So, in honor of the Star Wars, I can't call it a trilogy anymore, the movies, here is a little multi-tool. So, if you ever caught needing to quickly open up your retro computer, or you're looking at one in a marketplace and you want to sort of get in there, here's the perfect multi-tool to have. So for a mere $29.99, you can have a Star Wars Millennium Falcon multi-tool kit. So screwdriver bits and adjustable spanner. It's got everything that you could possibly need. So put it in your pocket and you'll be prepared.
My favorite part is, with the Falcon, of course, it's got those two kind of prongs that stick out from the front of the ship.
Yeah.
That's what it gets adjusted here to act as a wrench. So you hold up the whole of your Falcon, two turns. That's awesome. Very funny.
I know that. Yeah. I've got to have it just for that.
Yeah. How useful this would be, I don't know, but it's neat looking. And even just if you just displayed it as like a little metal model that wasn't quite accurate, that's fun. And then it's there in a pinch should you quickly need a screwdriver. So I dig it. And for $30 and it's all metal like that, I say it's worth it.
Yeah, I kind of wonder if that you know, that particular wrench bit wasn't the inspiration for the entire idea. Yep. It's like, oh, you know what that looks like.
Yeah, and what else can we add on to it? But no.
Yeah.
So, yep. It's definitely going on my wish list. So it's... just a lovely bit of Star Wars kitsch. Love it. Okay, well, moving right along into things that we can buy. Carrington, why aren't I surprised with your items?
Well, you should be. It's one of those things where I picked it and it was available. It is now no longer available because I wasn't sure how long it would take us to record, and we've gone over longer than I thought it would be. This show's always longer than I think it would be. So you can't buy the thing I picked, but I'm not changing my pick anyway because I really like it. And it's a Quadra 840 AV. I think it's one of Apple's best Macs of the classic Mac era. It's one that I had, and I somewhat foolishly at the time got the board upgrade to an 8100. So I turned it into a PowerPC, which at the time was like maybe a good thing to do. Let's make it a faster and yet slower for everything I'm actually doing with it computer. But looking back on it now, I would much rather have an 840 AV than an 8100. I think it's one of the pinnacles because you got the full 040, rockingly fast computer. It's a great mini tower size, super easy to open up and add cards in and multiple drives. I've really liked it. It's probably my favorite tower computer that Apple has ever made. I really like it. They're relatively rare on eBay. This one had only a few bids when I picked it, and over the last hour, it got bid up quite a bit and went for, I think, over $200, $225, which is a little pricey, I think, but they're hard to come by in nice working condition and not super yellowed. The case of the 840s or the 840 AV and the front plate seem to yellow at very different ways and very different speeds. So frequently when you look at one, part of it will be hideously yellow, and that makes it even worse because it really jumps out. Whereas this one had nice coloring, fully functional. Didn't ship to Canada. I wouldn't have picked it up anyway because who wants to drop $225 for a tower? But still, I like it. I like it very much. The 840 AV has a soft spot in my heart, so I picked it. As a secondary, small pick, I am pointing out something I think you should definitely not purchase, which is a Quadra 605 prototype. And prototype should be in quotes here because it's not a prototype. This person wants $1,500 for this computer. So as a public service, I'm letting our listeners know that of course it's not a prototype. Holy moly. Now the 605 is essentially equivalent to the LC475. And I love this line of computers. The only real difference with the 605 is you've got that different sort of smoother Quadra front plate. I like the LC a little better, but they're great computers. They can take the Apple IIe card, but you have to choose between that and Ethernet. But it's relatively fast, really easy to upgrade to a full 604, rather a full 040. So it's a really good computer, especially for running early versions of System 7 or System 6. So I think it's a terrific computer. But it was at that stage where Apple was switching over to soldered ROMs. So the earliest of the 605s has the ROM as a slotted thing. So you have a ROM card in a slot. And the later versions of the exact same computer, they just switched the board and it came soldered. This listing says, I want $1,500 for this because it's clearly a prototype because it has a ROM on a card. I'm like, no, that just means it's one of the first 7,000 of them. So not a prototype, and worth about 10 times less than the buy it now price. But neat to see because I like the 605. So those are my choices. 840 AV mm-hmm. plus 605 equals something.
Yeah, I find this particular case style always looks a little weird to me because I keep seeing that disk drive slot as like a mouth. Just always, I don't know, there's something very anthropomorphic about it.
Yeah, I like the LC 475 and 476 are essentially the exact same computer, but I like the look of the 475 a little bit better. So I mean, there's very little difference between them, but they both have that weird looking mouth slot thing. But I like the 475 better.
Mm. Yeah, I just this has nothing to do with the auctions, but I just caved in. I think it was maybe like a week and a half ago or something, and bought two of the sort of like the miscellaneous models that I had along the way when I was, you know, back in the actual day. I had a Quadra 650 and a PowerMac 7180, you know, which are just sort of miscellaneous, like one of the many numbered models that were there at the time. But I sort of figured I have to get this because I foolishly got rid of mine at the time. So.
See, I love the 2E card. The Apple IIe card is a fantastic thing. I think it's amazing. And honestly, if I could only have a single retro computer, it would be an early Mac that can take a 2E card with the 2E card in it. Because you get, depending on the model you pick, a really good vintage Mac to play around. And you also get a very capable 2E that's networkable and you can take screenshots on and hook up any monitor to it. And like, it's really, really good. Love the 2E card. So you can put them in the Color Classic or Color Classic 2 if you can get a hold of one of those, but who can? Or like the LC series in, up to the 475 and the 575 as well if you want a built-in monitor. And like, lots of different options for very good early Macs and the 2E card. And if you can get them all together with that special cable, I think it's a really nice setup. And but not for $1,500. Like, oh my goodness.
I wonder if you could. So it occurs to me that the, and now we're completely off track, but the Mac TV had, it was basically one of those
Yeah, I think it was the 575 was the Mac, or 550. Anyway, one of those. Yeah, it was just a black version of one of those. Yeah.
And so the thing that made it special was, you know, apart from it being black, was that it had a TV tuner card in it. So, I mean, basically that TV tuner card was available for the non-black version as well, but this one just, like, it was marketed as a TV. So I think my guess is you could take the TV card out and put a 2E card in. it would kind of slightly ruin the Mac TV.
Yeah, but the black, but the look of it, though, I love the Mac TV cool. because of that black color. And I would prefer
emulating a Bell and Howe.
I would, yeah, exactly. But I would prefer the 2E card to that relatively crappy TV, TV at 240 by 160 resolution or whatever it gave you, like, at 15 frames a second.
Actually, from what I remember, actually the TV has better resolution than the actual Mac.
Oh, nice!
It'll switch to the TV, so it's kind of irritating because, of course, I think there's a mod you can do or something to increase the Mac's output so that it'll actually take full advantage of the monitor that's in there. But in its default mode, the Mac board doesn't, it has to switch to a lower resolution.
But of course, with the, my other choice with the 840 AV, that was the fun of those, like that whole AV card. The 840 AV was a remarkably good thing for doing video stuff. It was crazy how good the video in was on that, to be able to just do pass-through stuff. You could pass it through and just bring it up on screen and be watching TV at the same, and it just wouldn't hit the computer at all. So for picture-in-picture stuff, just fantastic. The 840 AV was such a remarkably capable computer.
Cool. I'll put it on my list.
Ah, there we are. Something he's looking for 2017. Okay. Well, I thought this time round I would go for some slightly oddball peripherals. So the first one is an InfoGrip BAT AT PS2 and ADB one-handed keyboard. Now, have either of you two gentlemen ever used one of these corded keyboards so that you just do all your character selection through various multiple keys, single hand use?
Yes, I have. They are awful.
I never have, but I
if you've got one hand, seven keys then on it's it. Great because you've got one hand. And so I'm very glad these exist, and I am like, accessibility stuff I am so in favor of. I love it. So I love that it exists. And if I needed to use one, I would be super happy that they do exist. But corded keyboards are just terrible. Terrible, terrible. I've never used this particular one, but I've used a bunch of them. And it's like you're playing the organ, and I never got used to it. And I did not enjoy it in the least.
Mm. No, I've only ever tried using one. I think
and this is a left-handed one twice. You've chosen too.
Well, you can never really pick which one hand you're going to use. But they were not only were they sold into the accessibility market, I've noticed lately that a lot of one-handed keyboards are going in for the gamers so that they can have keyboard one hand and then they can have their gamer mouse in the other. So, and then I suppose they're also going to be wired up with their headset and mic. And, but my big problem was is that getting any two fingers or just doing it, I always found my trouble was sort of like, I know what buttons I'm supposed to be pushing, but I can't tell my fingers to do it. I'd go for one combination, I'd get some other combination. So
if you're going to do the recording stuff, if you... One thing that does help is if you put on a Phantom of the Opera mask, one of those half face masks, it can get you more in the mood for courting, and I find that helps. That's a pro tip from me to you.
Okay. I had never thought of doing that, and I wonder why.
The Phantom of Kansas Fest will put you up on like a fourth floor, and you'll just come over the intercom every once in a while and threaten us.
I like that idea. Anyway,
I thought you might.
Moving right along, so what could be more enjoyable than using a one-handed keyboard? It's a one-handed keyboard and mouse all in the same unit. So what we have here is the Twiddler, the mouse that can type. So not only do you have to be able to use a series of esoteric chord combinations for your typing, you actually have a movement sensor for your mouse. So I think I would be totally lost on this. I've tried using modern Air Mouse for, you know, controlling TVs and things like that, and I have more than enough trouble with that. And to actually be using it as a corded keyboard at the same time, I think I would implode. But again, it's an interesting piece of technology. This one, I believe, is from about 1991. The VAT keyboard's a little bit newer. I think that was a 94, but just the aesthetic of the styling makes it look a lot older than what it actually is. But this one, the photos of the auction, you'll see all the cables in there. So I suspect that there's going to be cables going back to the keyboard input as well as the serial port for the mouse. And there is also in the photos, the looks like the back of the box. So there's a little bit of information on the unit itself. So very interesting to look at. And I think at $80 Australian, that's about $60 US, I'll be letting this one go by to some other avid collector.
I think this is really cool, though. I mean, like, yeah. I don't know that I would
Paul's
have any
gonna buy
luck
it.
Using it. But,
yeah.
Well, all right, let's see.
I like how the box on the back of it, when it describes, it says, like, at last, there's a small one-handed. Like, people were waiting for this, were they? Is this an at last item? But at last, touch type on a pocket size keyboard. It's like, oh, I've been waiting for this.
Yeah. So I could you imagine using this in the office? I get enough strange looks from people already, but if I was actually waving this around as my mouse, as well as trying to type and not swear while doing it.
And it originally came with a 3-year warranty. I like something that comes with a warranty longer than you would possibly use the product. So that's really a forever warranty. Essentially,
I think a 5-minute warranty would be more than what I would need for that one. But as far as putting it in the collection, I think it'd be a great conversation starter. I'm sure people would love trying to use it, but I don't think I could use it as a productivity tool. So we've got a one-handed mouse and keyboard, a one-handed keyboard. So I'm just going to top it off, just finish this off with a 1 gigabyte, 2.5-inch flash drive. So, what's so special about a 1 gigabyte SSD? Well, to start with, it's a IDE, so it's not a SATA. So here is a great little solid state solution to replace a failing hard drive. So if you've got any early laptops or even a early desktop machine that just put this into an adapter, and I think it'd be a great now. What I really love about it is the price. So I'm currently seeing it on special for the princely sum in US dollars, $6.08.
Nothing says quality like a $6 one gig flash drive.
So, yeah. Yep.
Well,
you better buy bulk and hook these things up in series, because I would not trust this at all. And I want to buy all of them. For that price, how do you not? Holy moly. Oh, it doesn't ship to Canada. We probably have laws against it. That's amazing.
But you got an older machine. You don't need more than 1 gig. But
that's an amazing price. That's like a shockingly ridiculous price.
Yeah. It's definitely in the it will cost more to post it to me than to purchase the unit. But
It's like a typo price. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, although 81 have sold already, so presumably they would have noticed by now. But I mean, it does sort of seem like the market for a 1 gigabyte drive is probably pretty, like, we are talking to most of the people right now who would be interested in something that small, because the real world probably has no demand for this at all.
No, but the fact that it's flash and ID and stuff, like I'm surprised you can get the case for this for $6. So this is pretty impressive. I like it.
Cool. By the way, I stuck I did a little search because I didn't want to buy a Twiddler from Australia.
There's a phrase.
First of all, it doesn't ship.
It'd be great if it actually been the Twiddler manufactured in Wangaratta.
If you guys don't think I'm referring to Michael as the Twiddler from Australia from now on, you are sorely mistaken.
Anyway, yeah, I was just going to mention there's a Twiddler 2 that is available for sale.
You're killing me, man.
This actually is USB.
So a Twiddler so, also.
Yeah.
As well.
The best thing about the Twiddler, though, is not the fact that it's got 12 buttons you have to do on your fingers, but there's also 6 thumb buttons. So you're like, wow, man, this must be the most complicated thing to quote unquote type on.
Right. I can type, you know, 4 words a minute.
And also, I have been very good at resisting all the jokes to do with one-handed keyboards. But the fact that it's called the Twiddler, you guys are really pushing your luck for keeping our not explicit tag, right? I'm just saying. If you're having me on the show talking about the one-handed Twiddler keyboard, I mean, I'm really holding it in right now. I'm just saying. I think you should appreciate the effort I've been putting in the last 15 minutes.
We very much do.
Yes, we do. So, Paul, what have you got that can out-twiddle the Twiddler?
Okay, well, actually, I put this link in long enough ago that I've kind of forgotten most of the things that I even knew about it, but this is an extra-rare Soviet dialogue computer. It is a clone of Irisha, and it is a... there's no information about it really, as far as like the internet or anything, but it's a pretty amazing looking computer. I mean, first of all, it's got a membrane keyboard, with Cyrillic all over it. But I mean, you can still, like, to the extent that you're able to sound it out, you can sort of see what it's supposed to be saying. Actually, the photos are pretty interesting because if you go sort of down the page to, they have a lot of photos in the actual sort of description.
Yeah,
there's a lot of photos.
A lot more photos in the body of the description than there is in the top section. So it's
remarkably clean.
You know, and it's shown starting. You know, there's a view larger picture. Let's see. So you plug it in, it says start, and I don't know what any of these things are. ADR 4000. Whatever it shows something on the screen, but it's all, you know, in I guess Russian, the Cyrillic at least, and so anyway, I thought it was sort of interesting. Certainly nothing I've ever heard of. It's a clone of something else that I haven't heard of, and I think it looks nice.
I was about to say I've never heard of it, nor have I heard of what it was cloned from.
I feel like when I put it in here, I had a little. Oh, it has serial number 14.
Ooh,
so
the second last one ever made.
Right, that's a okay, here we go. Yeah, there's a little bit more information in the I knew I was supposed to know more about this, but the description says a little bit about it. So one of the things it says is that the seller asked fans of old computers, and no one knows anything about it, the thing it was cloning was apparently designed for teaching computer science at schools. So if you're of exactly the right age and you grew up in Moscow or something, then you might know what this is.
Remember how we talked at the beginning of the show about how you need 2 people interested to make a bid successful on auction sites? Well, this fails that test.
Yeah, I think so. You can buy it now for US $297.
Are you going to get it, Paul? Are you going to get
shipping?
It?
I am not. But it's shipping from Belarus. So
$40 for me.
Anyway. It's interesting. Actually, if you are interested in sort of like Soviet, you know, Eastern Bloc type computers, there is, I don't think it's this seller, but there are a lot of them, actually, that have been showing up recently on eBay.
Well, sure, now that you guys, let's not go political.
right. But there's a seller, I think the name Dragon is in the seller's ID, but just all kinds of largely Spectrum clones, but there are some like PDP clones. We talked about the Electronica, whatever it is, BK-011 or something like that. There's a lot of these. There are enough that, the first one seemed interesting, and when there's 40 of them, then suddenly I feel like I'm out of my depth. So, okay, I'll move on to the next one. The next one also has not yet been bought. It is a buy it now of $5,000, but it is a Androbot Topo.
I want this so badly, but I would never spend that kind of money, but this is so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it may actually be only free local pickup. Like, you know, you have to go to Los Altos, California to get it. Maybe that is appropriate though. Because I would hate to risk this thing, but yeah, I've always kind of loved these things. It's hard to describe exactly what it looks like. But it's a little, you know, humanoid robot that rolls around on these angled wheels. And it was featured on the cover of lots of computer magazines in the, you know, like when it was new, because it's one of those very futuristic things. I don't know if it talks, but it looks like a person, you know, enough that it looks like what people thought robots would be like in the future.
And they're tall. These things, I think, are like 3 feet tall or something. It's big, not tiny robots. Mm-hmm. Nolan Bushnell made this, right? I think this was his thing.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, and actually this is signed by him.
Ooh, wow.
Geez. Number 336, and it has a little plaque with his signature on it. I'm not 100%. It looks like a mass-produced signature.
Oh, okay. But
nevertheless. So, yeah, I mean, this is one of those things that if I happened to know somebody who had one in the basement and was going to, you know, give it away, I would love to have it. But they're very sought after.
I would.
And then, you know, you wouldn't want to buy it.
But I would certainly put it in a movie.
Yeah, I'd fly over and tackle you before you could get to the basement to collect it.
Yeah, right. Anyway, but yeah, so if you wanted to look at, I do think it is kind of cool to see them in modern, current photographs, you know, because these are the things that you remember seeing, you know, in cruddy black and white ads and, you know, magazines. But now we have actual, you know, photographs of what they are like.
Have you ever seen one in real life? I have not.
I have not, yeah. No. I've seen a Hero, though.
We met at Kansas Fest ages ago. Oh, yeah, I went there.
yes, right. okay, let's see. I will move on to the next one. Next one, this is not one I'm necessarily recommending getting, but it's kind of interesting to see. It is a 1980 BASIC compiler for the TRS-80 from Microsoft. So what's kind of cool about it is basically just this is really early Microsoft. It's earlier, I think, than anything I have from Microsoft for the Apple. This is, you know, BASIC's what Microsoft started with. So this is in a red binder that with a really kind of crazy Microsoft written on the side, on the spine. Doesn't look anything like any logo you've ever seen from them. It's like 70s neon or something like that. but it's kind of cool to look at.
They made a BASIC compiler for the Apple II as well, which I think came in a little binder like this.
Slightly more modern, but yeah, the AppleSoft compiler, Task. They made one. Yep.
Yeah. That was it, yeah. I've never seen this compiler for the TRS-80. I didn't even know there was a BASIC compiler for the TRS-80. Though for all I know, there's 100 of them. I'm out of the TRS-80 loop.
Yeah. Anyway, no, I thought it's kind of an interesting thing. They want $90 for it and $89 for it, and it's not... it might actually not be a crazy price, except that, you know, I don't care enough. But maybe you do. And at any rate, it's kind of neat to look at the pictures. Okay, moving on to the next one I had was, I just came across this, I don't know if this is a good deal or not, but you can get, this seller has cartons of double-sided, double-density, 5.25-inch discs
boxes. That's cartons as in a pallet of cartons.
Well, so, yeah, and I think they're selling them by the individual carton, so you can see the pallet of these, but each one contains 10 boxes of 10, so they're 100.
Oh, and there's 7 currently available, so you could pick up 700 floppy disks if you wanted.
Yeah, and so the price is $89 buy it now, was that it? I think that's exactly what the Microsoft thing was too. Well, okay, how about that? So either buy the Microsoft compiler or
100
disks. but these are KAO disks, which I think are those have been pretty reliable for me, and they're, I think, made more recently than most of the other brands.
Yeah, it's funny. It's a brand that I never used back in the day, but I have had success with in the last 10 years.
Mm. Right. Yeah, me too. And, you know, these are the double density ones, not high density. So those are harder to find, but those are the ones you need usually, for, for our kinds of pursuits. Mm-hmm. And it's less than $1 a disc. Mm. You know, I mean, it's not free or cheap even, well, but it might
it
be
cheaper.
Looks
like you could even get them cheaper. It says in the description that the special acquisition, 400 cartons available, discount for large orders.
Interesting. But so I wonder, it does claim that there are only 7 available.
No, I think it is an eBay thing. So I think that's not okay. Normally like about, you can put a quantity, I think it's about 10 or 20.
So it means they'll probably just keep putting them up. Nice. Mm. Cool.
Yeah.
Good find.
So, yeah, if you're looking for these, I think I have a couple of these. I'm looking at one right now, in fact. So I'm not going to be getting them myself. I will not compete with you, but... but it is, it's good to,
I think there's,
it's good to have these available.
There's plenty to go around there. Be, yeah, kept in a climate controlled government warehouse, free from moisture and elements, has only been stored with the occasional alien spacecraft. Oh, oops, sorry. Okay.
Okay. And then the last thing, another thing that just showed up, in the last day or so is a TI-99-4, which they almost never come up. So, here is one. I was the first bidder, but that didn't last very long. And I now believe that I will not be winning or bidding further, so I'm announcing it to the world. Sour grapes, I guess maybe that is, but anyway, no, you don't see these too often. This is a TI-99-4, not a TI-99-4.
Oh, that's it. I'm gonna say, I see these all the time. Yes, I see the 4A all the time. So what's the difference between a 4 and a 4A?
The keyboard's better on a 4A. I'm not quite sure what to call this. It might something like a Chiclet keyboard. It's not a full motion keyboard, and I think it has less RAM, and I think the video chip is less good. It's a terrible computer.
So why would somebody want this? It's the crappy early version of a computer. Okay. I would like to announce I will not be bidding on this.
Right. It's the history of it. Although I do have a 99-4, like a silver black 99-4A, and I'm intending to kind of get, you know, to try it out and see what I think of it. I don't think it's that great. And this is the worst version.
And the 4A is something you can pick up relatively inexpensively. I see those on eBay all the time for very low double digits, like $30, including a box kind of thing. So you can pick those up really cheaply.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I think that they're probably not too bad, really.
That was their slogan, actually.
What you want to do is play games. Not too bad, really.
Texas Instruments, not too bad, really.
Well, and these are the ones I think, I'm trying to remember, I think these might have been the ones that they started selling at a total loss because they had to get rid of them. But so anyway, here's a 99-4 if you were looking for one. I think these come up something like once a year. So right now it's at $51, but that's as of, you know, like one day has gone by and there are 6 days left as we record. Okay, that's it. I'll stop there.
Okay, well, I think that pretty well wraps up the eBay section. So just some closing discussions or anything you want to throw out there. So, Carrington, I see that you've been busy.
Have I? Oh, yes. Kevin Savitz has a new podcast. It's excellent. Called Eaten by a Gru, where he and some other folks, or some other fellow anyway, play and then talk about Infocom games. So there are 2 episodes out so far. I am the other fellow, but you should listen to it for Kevin. It's super fun to do, but we both really enjoy Infocom things, and Kevin had been looking for a while, I guess, for an excuse to play them all, and then I joined him in that excuse. So he invited me on the show, and I have stayed. And so we did Zork 1 for the first episode, and then Ballyhoo for the second one, and we're currently playing Trinity, which will be our third episode, come out sometime in January. Roughly monthly shows, no fixed schedule, just however long it takes us to play the games. Super fun to do. So if you are interested in Infocom games and our thoughts on them, then you can tune in. We'll have a link in the show notes.
Yeah, I am thinking about using that as an excuse to play them myself, but they're hard.
The feedback has been crazy, and compared to most podcasts, it's really fun to when people are like sort of playing along, and that's a new experience. Like, so people on Twitter will say, oh, I'm stuck here or whatever. And so they're playing the games as we play them. And that's really, really neat. And so I'm enjoying that part of the experience very, very much. But the games, yeah, I'm cheating like crazy. So if you play the games, feel free to cheat. That's what I'm doing.
Well, I must admit, of all the games that when I played them new, I don't think I ever got through any of the games without some third-party assistance.
Right, right.
Well, Kevin and I were talking about that before. We're wondering if now there was our intention is to make our way through all of them, if it's a skill, like if you'll get better if you play a bunch of them, if you start to think like an Infocom puzzle solver. And I wonder if, you know, 10 games down, I improve my skills at them. We'll see. Right now, I'm at the point where I'm reading hints and InvisiClues and walkthroughs and still barely getting through the games, but they're super fun.
Yeah. So it'll be a while before it becomes relevant, but I'm kind of curious to know if you're going to go into the late ones. I think Infocom did some pretty weird stuff later on, like graphical things, didn't they? I thought
Yes, they did. And also a database. We don't know if we'll actually do that one.
Yeah, I was hoping you would do the database. Cornerstone, right? I think.
But there's, Fublitsky, which is the game. Maybe we could play that at Cancer Fest or something. But mostly it's just like a reason to have fun. And in case you want to play the games, and so that shies you away from the show, we have like a spoiler fence. So the first half of each episode, we talk about the game in general, but we try not to give any spoilers. Then there is a specific point where we say, okay, now come the spoilers. And then we talk about the game more specifically, including the puzzles and solutions and that sort of thing. So you can listen to the first half of any show to see if a game would appeal to you, maybe before you play it. And we ideally won't ruin the game for you if you listen to the first bit.
Yeah, I quite like that idea with the spoil gate and going through the spoil gate for the second half. So I gather you're not trying to do them in chronological order, but
whim, total whim.
Yep. So is there any method in your madness of choosing the game, is it just madness
first
in your
one,
method?
We picked Zork 1 because it was the first Infocom game, so it just seemed like a logical starting place. Ballyhoo for the second one, simply because Kevin let me pick, and I figured I'd stick with ones I had played before, so I would save. I'm the kind of person who will eat like the food on the plate that I don't like as much as the other stuff, saving the good things for last. I must save the good for last, so I wanted to save some games I hadn't played for later, so I picked Ballyhoo, and then because I'd already played it. And then for the third game, he picked Trinity, and that sounded fun. It's strictly going to go by whim. I mean, odds are good we would play Zork 2 before we play Zork 3, but other than that, I don't think there's going to be any method at all to any of the madness. Anyway, it's just an excuse to play games and interact with other people who might want to play them too.
Yep.
That's it.
Very cool.
Couldn't ask for anything more, apart from not being eaten by a group.
Yeah.
Okay, well, nothing interesting happening at my end of the world, apart from just trying to tidy up down here in the bunker so I can make room so I can put more computers out on a desk at any one time. But, apart from trying to find something that you might have bought maybe once or twice in the past, Paul, is there anything else that's happening in your end of the world?
No, I don't think so. I think I'm hoping, I guess this is sort of a perspective thing, but I'm becoming more and more committed to the idea of kind of reworking the way my pipeline of getting things scanned and out and posted and, you know, like off my hard drive. And, you know, because I've done a lot of scanning and I have not done a lot of releasing. So,
you know, that's one of the reasons I'm currently tidying up so that I can actually get a scanner set up down here, because I do have a growing input list, and I really need to get some of it scanned just to make it a lot easier for me to go through it. And then, as you've done, anything that I do get round to scanning, then I shall be uploading and also putting it into the Internet Archive.
Excellent.
Okay. Well, that's it for this show. You can find notes for this show and all our shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us over in the VC Fed forums at vcfed.org. You can follow the RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. And you can join our Facebook group. Just go to Facebook and search for RCR Podcast. And of course, we always look forward to your feedback, so drop us an email to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. Where you can tell us what was your favourite acquisition of 2016 or what was the biggest surprise. And we're also members of the Throwback Network, which you can find at throwbacknetwork.net. And of course, to help others find this podcast, if you could just find the time to put a review in iTunes, it would be greatly appreciated. So, until next time,
Retro Compute!